Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for August 21st.
You nailed it.
Yes. Tomorrow's my birthday, so.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
You're welcome. I forgot. You're welcome. So.
You've only been saying it for the last.
Month. Well, I've been trying to celebrate for the whole month. I've been counting.
How old are you going to be now?
What? Why would you ask that?
I forget.
Don't you know? I don't think I need 42? To say it. No.
41?
Yes.
Okay. You look 25.
I didn't know that we were going to say my age on the air for the whole world.
Are you one of those people who are sensitive about your age?
No, I mean, I'm not sensitive. I just don't want to talk about it.
50 is a new 40. Or what, 60 is a new 40 or something like that, I heard. You're not middle age until you hit, like...
75?
Because we're all living to 135 an hour, whatever.
Still, though, I just don't want to discuss it anymore. I thought we were going to talk about the eclipse. Okay. So...
What prophetic significance do you see in the...
I wondered if you wanted to go first. What is your prophetic word? What do you think God is going to do?
Well, we saw today what's his name? I forget the prophet's name. He was saying there was a double rainbow over the White House.
When? Yesterday?
Or like recently.
A while ago.
Yeah, so there's a double rainbow over the White House, which is a sign of God's covenant, right? I mean, it's a sign of God's... So God has his covenant with America. And then today, there's going to be an eclipse.
Which...
That's not a coincidence. And then on August 28th in 2021, there will be another eclipse, but the sun going crosswise, making a cross.
And that's 7 years from now? Because it's going to be said it's a seven-year tribulation.
I don't know. But the path of the eclipse will cross over the path of this eclipse like a cross.
So
the rainbow over the White House, the eclipse is coming within 7 years of each other.
And then the...
Yeah, so I mean, how do you explain that other than you know...
I mean, I thought there were just regular eclipses. I thought this was a thing that sort of happened.
Read your Bible. The sun will be made dark at noon, or in our case, 2:31, but p.m.
Yeah, it's... I think that the eclipse is a sign of destiny for anybody who looks into the sun at 2:31 will be destined for a new kind of life that they've never experienced before. Their eyes will be changed. they will be... Yeah, that's all I've got.
The real question is what's his name? Chris asked. Christ or whatever.
Oh yeah, John.
What are the eclipses in your life?
Yeah, no. What are the moons in your life?
Right.
You're covering destined over the light, for a right? solar eclipse. The local Methodist Church, which is wonderful, they do cool signs or cool, funny things on their. I don't know if they're trying to be funny, though. I think maybe they are. I can't tell if they're serious, but their sign read, "We are solar powered, S-O-U-L-E-R, by the sun, S-O-N."
People wanted me to do that. Like when we first got our sign, people were saying we should make...
Let's do fun things.
Pithy.
Yeah. Solar powered by the sun.
That, you know, there's like instant conversions as people were driving past that.
Well,
wait. I could be solar powered by the sun.
I wonder who the sun is. Because I have no...
Stop and go into that church and ask the pastor. He's not there because it's Monday.
I have no Christian background at all, so I don't even know what we're talking about. Yeah. I managed to not say anything to our children about the eclipse for months, as people have been buying fake glasses online, but then the cat was out of the bag yesterday, and they found out about it. So
I'm not sure what's the big deal. It's just I don't understand why everyone's so excited about it.
And the reason that I didn't want to tell the children is because I'm a bad homeschooler. Yeah. Like, this should have consumed all of our lives.
Why?
Because of science and stuff. But I just went, I didn't want to deal. Because I can't answer questions about it. I can't tell them anything.
Now the cat's out of the bag.
So I guess we'll have to spend the afternoon watching YouTube clips about solar eclipses. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah. Well, and we also have to keep them inside so they're not blinded. But it's going to be...
Do you think little Eleanor or Muriel...
They're going to run out and go, look, Mommy! Look at the sun! And that'll be it.
But we're not... We don't have a full eclipse. We only have 75%. Can you still be blinded with...
Apparently, anytime you look at the sun, you can be blinded. So...
So but what makes this a special time?
You're more inclined to look at it because it's unusual.
Actually, so it's not like a special searing power of the eclipse sun that makes it blinded. It's just the fact that you're looking at the sun.
I think so.
Really? Because I look at the sun with sunglasses on all the time and no problem. But they say you have to have special glasses.
Oh, you know what?
I think there's like some searing, like super solar power exuded by the sun during an eclipse that sears your eyeballs off or something. Like literally your eyes burn.
Obviously,
out.
This is a big part of our lives, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about it. So, yeah.
I hope it doesn't cloud over so we can see it or rain.
I can't even check the weather because our internet is bad, which is also a sign of the end times. So, what are your hopes for the apocalypse after today, though? Because I assume this means the world is over.
What are my hopes for the apocalypse?
Like, what are you going to do this afternoon?
Well, we got to start
when the world is a ball of fire and
digging big holes in our backyard for the bunker.
Well, our dogs have got a head start on that, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're going to do that today. Our holiday is officially over, and so we thought we'd do
it. This was one of the best holidays we've had here, right? Because otherwise.
Well, we've only had one other one, and it wasn't great.
Right, because back in those days, our house was right next to the church. And we looked out the back window, and there.
Well, there was the brick wall of the church. Was the brick,
but here, we're separated from the church, so we actually had. We actually had space, and we were able to have a whole month of...
People left us alone, which is really nice of them. I mean, that sounds bad. Of course, we love all the people in our church, and we want to see them all the time. So it must have been a coincidence that people didn't get in touch with us. But so we were going to... First of all, what did you read this month?
Oh, right. We were going to talk about books. I finished that French Revolution book, which was really good. It's called Citizens by, I always forget its name, Shema. Anyway.
That sounds sketchy.
900 pages, and it was huge. But
how many hours of listening?
Yeah, it's a great thing. I didn't have to read. If I had to read a 900-page book, I'd still be reading it. But I listened to it on Audible, and it was great. It was really a good book. Yeah, except for the fact that every time, when you read, he insisted on pronouncing all of the French names in French, and exactly as the French person would do it. So I didn't understand him when he was saying Robespierre or Danton. Danton, whatever. I call it Danton. It's not Danton.
It's not Danton.
Yeah, it's Danton. And then.
It's not Robespierre.
and then, how do you say
Robespierre?
Yeah, whatever. But he was mangling all the names by saying
he
in
wasn't
French.
Mangling.
Why can't they? When you're reading a book in English, pronounce the names of the places as an English person would have them pronounced.
Actually, I hate to agree with you because I listened to the Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, which was also great.
Yeah.
But the reader of the book insisted on pronouncing all the names in their sort of Arabicized Arabic-ness, and it was hard. Even place names I knew because I knew the more French way of saying them, he pronounced them in a more Arabic way or, you know, North
And it was
African.
Irritating, wasn't it?
It was a little bit irritating.
But it was very
irritating.
Authentic.
He wasn't
allowing the authentic. Names of those places to be culturally...
Yes, appropriated by me, the listener.
Right.
So, yeah, that was hard. I finally got used to it. I figured out, was able to orient myself, but it was a little bit irritating.
Well, the thing I did like about the book is that, like, it was, it, you know, usually when the French Revolution is spoken of, I mean, the terror, of course, is seen as a bad thing, but, you know, the monarchy was so horrible, and Louis the 16th was such a awful guy, and Marie Antoinette was, you know, but this book actually
debunks it a little bit.
Right, yeah. I mean, there was really no, the French monarchy was not that, wasn't horrible.
No worse than any other monarchy. Right,
well, no, well, actually, it was functioning fairly well, and it was slowly moving toward a kind of constitutional monarchy,
so that you would have had. They would have gotten there eventually. They could have
had something like what England has. And in fact, originally, that's what many of the people kind of wanted, was more of a constitutional monarchy, and it turned out to be a complete bleb fest. Because kind of the same thing with the Russian Revolution, you had the...
you had a thought, a purity of thought. Right. That sort of grew up and had to... It took over the whole thing.
Right. I mean, driven by... I mean, I think we talked about it in last week's podcast, but the philosophy of the vox populi being the voice of truth, what the people say. And then, of course, you have to have people who are representing the people so that you know what the people are saying. And that turns out to be, you know, the Committee for Public Safety or the Jacobins or the...
horrible.
Right. Well, in that same way it was in the Russian Revolution, that the people, the vanguard of the people happens to be the Communist Party, which decides what the people really want.
Really want. as they die more and more in the streets. Exactly. Yeah.
So.
Well, I think that was interesting because Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, or, you know, ISIS has the same, it's not purity of, they're not on behalf of the people, but they're looking for pure Islam, you know, a pure expression of something that nobody in Timbuktu wanted, or, you know, Gao or Northern Mali. Everybody just wanted to carry on with their lives and not have their, you know, pure Islam enforced on them.
Yeah.
But I think it's so interesting because the purity of every kind of expression is what's coming more and more to the surface of American life. More people should learn about the French Revolution.
Oh, I think, yeah, if you read it now, reading the French Revolution, why all this alt-right stuff was going on and Antifa stuff was going on, is fascinating because same kind of thinking, same kind of intolerance of anything but the purest ideology coming to the fore. So
it's human, it's what humanity insists on, even when they talk about, you know, everybody thinks they're tolerant and
right,
wonderful, but this is the thing that we all do eventually if we're given license, unbridled right, license towards
right,
that's where we'll all go.
Right.
Yes. Well, I read the Timbuktu book, which I recommend. It was really interesting. It was difficult, though, when they actually described Sharia in Northern Mali. I found that tough. I don't like suspense and bloodshed. But, and then I also read, Moments and Days by Michelle Van Loon, which I'm going to write about. That was really great. That was the Jewish calendar, or sort of ecclesiastical year. Mm-hmm. That's, I'm putting two words together that don't go together. And then the Christian year.
Yeah.
Side by side. So she described both of those.
And does she say that the Christian year is comparable, or what does she...
Well, she's a Christian. She's a Jewish messianic, or she was Jewish and she converted. So she really knows the Jewish year well, the way that real religious Jews celebrate the year. And then she knows the Christian year as well. So she kind of pointed to where they join, you know, they where they overlap and where they're very, very different. And I think she encourages Christians to know what happens in the Jewish year, the Jewish festal year.
Most of us don't have a clue. That's the way people have always served Yahweh. They've always differentiated the year in a different...
Right. There's a secular liturgical year
aspect to the year.
And a liturgical year.
Right. But the, you know, most evangelicals think that's, you know, importing some kind of foreign
right,
idea into the...
Well, and they've made up, they make up their own. You have an evangelical...
liturgical year.
Liturgical year. You have money, you have Valentine's Day.
February is the Valentine's Day season.
Right.
So you have to talk about sex and love and marriage.
Love and...
in their sermons.
And then Christmas is Christmas, I guess.
Right.
And Easter is Habakkuk.
Easter begins right after Christmas.
Easter begins right after Christmas.
Well, no, actually Valentine's Day.
But after Valentine's Day.
And then the summer is the movie sermon time.
Movie sermons.
Right, so you have to go through the...
Well, Wonder Woman.
Right, you have to have the Wonder Woman sermons.
There was the Wonder Woman blessing or whatever.
Right,
the,
yeah, I remember that. The...
So, strangely enough, that's not in the Old Covenant. There's no Wonder Woman blessing or feast day. Disappointing, I would say. So I found it very interesting and helpful, especially I'm the Christian part. I was a lot more familiar with since we live that way. But the Jewish feasts were really helpful and interesting. And I really wish that we could eat our way through the Jewish calendar, the Jewish liturgical year.
We try. We do that. Every once in a while, we'll cook that shakshugan.
Well, that is our own. No, we make shakshugan Ash Wednesday. That's not a thing. That's not a Jewish
thing. Oh, that's just our own thing.
Jewish. It is a Jewish dish.
When we were in Jerusalem, the food was so good. I know that they had the split from the dairy side and the non-dairy side, but either side you went to, it was really good. I was surprised you could make a good sauce without any kind of dairy or cream in it, but it's delicious.
It's like unfathomable.
I know. I don't do it.
But yeah, it was really delicious. We always went for the meat side, so we should have gone more for the dairy side because we could have.
Right.
But no, I think we should try to eat our way through the, the Feast of Booths.
We should stick all the kids outside in a little tent. Shack.
Yeah. And I think we should make jelly donuts in Hanukkah for Rosh Hashanah or something. Obviously, I retained a lot of important information. The jelly donut thing stood out to me, but I didn't fix it to the actual day.
Right.
So, no, that was a great book. And it's an admonishment to not be rushing along like the average Westerner. And then I also read... I told the children to be quiet. That's not the name of the book. But I think it would be a great name of a book. I read Is the Bible Good for Women by Wendy Alsop.
I'm on pins and needles here. Is it is it good for women?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it's also a good book. So I think the book would be well suited to people who are already Christians and who already know that the Bible is good for women, but who want to be able to articulate to women who believe that it is not good.
Why women think it isn't good for the Bible? Or the Bible isn't good for men?
Oh, I mean, most of the women in our culture.
Submission stuff and the,
no secular women in our culture think that the Bible is good for them. So I think this is a good equipping book for people who already are committed to the scripture, but need to have a better grasp and like to think through it and to kind of have their hands on exactly why. So she deals with really tough things, the Levite's concubine, which always fascinates me, the thing in Deuteronomy about having to marry the person who rapes you. She talks about Dinah. She talks about the New Testament and I don't permit women to speak. She talks about the hair covering issues.
Does she not just unpack it but explain it away, or does she?
No, she unpacks it. She shows. I thought the bravest one was the man who rapes the woman has to marry her, and everybody in America would say, well, the woman, it put the emphasis on the woman, she has to marry her rapist. But the question is actually that the man has to take responsibility for and take care of this woman for the rest of her life.
I mean, he's now paying, upwards to thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of
and
dollars.
He can never divorce her. It's the one instance where there's no possibility of divorce. And and give her her conjugal rights, which means she gets to have children,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge thing, and status in the community.
If that law wasn't there, if that law did not require the man to marry her, then she wouldn't be married anyway. I mean, no one would marry
her. Nobody would marry her, right? So she would be shamed forever.
Right.
No status, no, cut off from the community.
Like Tamar, right?
Yeah.
So Tamar, Amnon didn't marry her.
Right.
He should have.
So she was destitute. She had nothing.
Right.
She took matters into her own hands. So Alsop does a good job of reframing, you know, saying you're saying all the wrong things, asking all the wrong questions. Here's how you have to look at it. I think she's very patient. So she's pretty apologetic. She's much more
would you
not apologetic
as, like,
in a
John MacArthur?
No. Yeah, so I think you would just be much more forthright about all of this. And Wendy is she's not cautious. I'm not saying that. She's very kind. She's very, not defensive either, just sort of saying many, many more times, please don't be offended, than I would probably say. So it's a really good book. If you struggle with those things and you're a Christian, you should read it too. But if you know somebody who hates God, I think this would be a really helpful book. And I think people should read it. Women should read it because it's, you know, I think most people cherry pick the texts they like and don't even look at these texts. So,
right, and then they run across it one day and they're
and then they're completely
in the Bible, and they're freaked out. Right?
Yeah, so I recommend both of these books, and I'm in the middle of No Little Women right now, which is also really good. So I really got to read this time. I really. We go on vacation and I never actually get to read. I take a huge stack of books and then I spend the whole time cleaning. And for whatever reason, this time I did spend a lot of time cleaning. We did major cleaning projects, but
we had a lot of time sitting, doing nothing,
which
is good.
Which is what I imagine is going to happen when we go away, but it doesn't.
Right.
I'm not sure why that is.
Well, usually we have, you know, we love going to visit family, but usually when we're visiting family, you wake up in the morning, you get ready, by 10 o'clock you're over at someone's house, and you spend the day there swimming or whatever, and then you come home, so there's really no time to read.
You don't just
visiting.
Sit down and read,
Which is great, it's fun to do that, but we're, you know, this was different, we were able to actually get...
I have a backlog of reading, because I haven't read over many... and then the other thing I got was, I know it's your turn, but I bought it myself a big fat, it's the diaries of Barbara Pym. So I've been reading her.
The diaries of Barbara Pym.
Yeah, what she's eating, who she's talking to, what did she wear today. She keeps track of it all. So I feel bad for not keeping more careful records, copies of things that I'm eating. So, it's your turn. What else did you read?
I'm just about finished with the Medici book, Power, Money, and Ambition in the Italian Renaissance by Paul Strathern. It's really good. And this is a guilty reading pleasure of mine, but I'm reading that alongside the Game of Thrones series. I decided to stop watching as much of the stuff because it's pretty bad. And I got it, you know, you can on... I know, I'm dooming myself in front of all of our listeners, but you can, on Amazon, skip past the bad parts, which I do. I know people don't believe it, but I do.
What kind of bad Christian are you?
I know. But I'm reading the books. I started read the books because they're less lurid, and you can you know when a sex part is coming, so you just skip the few pages or whatever that's there. But actually, I'm listening to it, so you just skip ahead on Audible. But it's interesting to listen to the Medici at the Game of Thrones at the same time. It's
the same
fascinating
thing.
right the way the Medici manipulated their way into power and the way they lived, and it's the hypocrisy of religion in the Medici, you're putting out, at least not all of them were hypocrites, but many of the Medici, you know, were very devout, but some had no concern at all for for faith, but they, but publicly, of course, they did. They were
right
in Rome and Italy and during the Renaissance. There was a growing sense of meh about faith, but and yet the art. Art all centered around faith. So it was, I mean, art almost became this kind of, I'm trying to find words here, but you would commission Michelangelo to do this wonderful statue. And the artists, Michelangelo's a bad example because he was very devout himself, but the artist may or may not believe any of the stuff that he's doing. You may not believe any of the stuff that, that you're commissioning to do. You're just interested in beauty and art.
And public works.
And like, public works, right. And meanwhile, you go home and you're sleeping with your mistress and you're having...
Wow.
While the artist is too. Not your mistress, but another...
They're all sleeping
or his boyfriend, right? There's a lot of homosexuality. I mean, homosexuality is rampant among the Renaissance upper classes and in Italy and in the art world especially. It's fascinating. But then you juxtapose that with
the actual with art
Game of
the,
Thrones,
oh, the and
it's like exactly the same kind of thing going on. So,
but the art that they made was like
gorgeous, beautiful,
so I mean, and helpful to many Christians.
Right. Michelangelo is a bad example because he was devout, but there were some who were not, and
who just,
but also created these masterpieces that were they're gorgeous. Meanwhile,
yeah.
Who did the first David? I forgot his name. Not the famous one by... Not the famous David in the Louvre, but...
Yeah, so...
Is it in the Louvre?
No, I'm sure that's not where it is.
I don't
think
know
it lives in
See,
Italy.
See, I'm such an art
I know, we should stop because we love science. I heart science. I heart art.
Right, right.
We're our...
Anyway, the guy who did the first David was a rampant homosexual. And so he crafted David as only a homosexual man... would.
Hmm. So.
Lovingly.
Lovingly. That's wonderful.
The buttocks and the back and the, I mean, it's just, it's crazy. It's seen now. If you don't know the history of who put it together, what he was doing and thinking when he was putting it together, you think.
Well, and it's objectively good.
Yeah.
Aesthetically,
oh, yeah, it's
so.
Beautiful, but. It,
yes.
The more famous David statue, the Catholic Church for a long time required there to be a loincloth.
A loincloth, really?
A golden loincloth around it. Because it was too lurid.
Yeah, well, I can see why.
Yeah. So those are my, and then the last book I'm reading is I'm just about finished, is Stephen Westerholm's Rethinking Justification, which is it's a very short book, but he's dealing with all the major points of the new perspective on Paul. Which is basically that Luther and the Reformation misunderstood Paul. Paul, writing from a Jewish context, was not opposed to the law as a in the sense that we understand it. So Luther said Luther always juxtaposes law against gospel, and his understanding of it was, at least the argument from the New Perspective people, is that Luther didn't see that Jews in the first century had a pretty good grasp of grace, the grace of election of the Jewish people, the fact that that works and faith were not seen as opposites. They were things that you when a Jewish rabbi would talk about doing good work, he wasn't juxtaposing that against grace. He was understanding that no good work could be done apart from grace. So there was always this kind of cooperative effort. And so Luther, the argument is, got first century Judaism wrong. And so he misunderstood
Paul
on justification in general. And Westerholm just destroys that argument. I mean, he shows how actually Paul was differentiating himself from Jewish thought.
Which he understood.
Which he understood. If by works, it's not by grace. No rabbi would not do, E.P. Sanders and Dunn, when talking about the law, would say, no, a rabbi in the first century would not recognize that distinction. But Paul makes that distinction very clearly in various places. So Paul is juxtaposing grace and works and saying justification can't be involved.
He's juxtaposing it because first century Judaism wasn't.
Yeah, he's standing out against it, right? And then he also takes on, you know, Paul, N.T. Wright's understanding of what righteousness is, because according to N.T. Wright, righteousness, as it's understood in the New Testament, the Old Testament, doesn't have anything to do with a moral standing. It has to do with, when you're talking about God's righteousness, you're talking about his keeping of covenant and keeping his promises to Israel. And when you're talking about our righteousness, it only means our being counted as part of the covenant community. It has no moral quality to it. So God declaring someone righteous or justifying someone only means, oh, well, now you're part of the covenant community. And God having made a promise to the covenant community to save it, I guess, to rescue it, will mean that, of course, you're justified. You have a right standing before God. But it has nothing to do with you being seen by God as having a moral quality, or God imputing any kind of moral quality to you.
That's Wright's
argument. Well, he says that stuff happens, but it doesn't happen in language of justification. So,
okay.
So Westerholm, I think, just destroys that. one, he thinks Wright doesn't quite understand the eschatological problem, and that is that human beings have to escape the wrath of God, and that's all over Paul.
Yeah.
And the wrath of God is coming because of sin, because of moral sin. And when you look at the word righteousness in the Old Covenant or Old Testament context, it clearly comes with a component of moral goodness or moral or wickedness. And so putting that together and showing how Paul uses the same concept of righteousness in the first in the New Testament, he shows that, you know, what Paul really was talking about, how to be counted as righteous morally in the face of a coming judgment, and that can only happen because of the atonement, the atoning work of Christ, and it only happens through faith, which is separated from grace. So he kind of puts back together, and he says his summary paragraph is, one of his summary paragraphs is that Luther pretty much had it right on justification and in faith. So it's a fascinating book. If you are troubled by the new perspective on Paul, or you're just a fanboy of N.T. Wright, you know, pick this book up, because it's really good.
I don't know why a fanboy would, or fangirl, would want to do that.
This is one of my pet peeves in Anglicanism, is so many people just love, N.T. Wright's a great writer, and he's a great speaker, and he's a brilliant mind. I don't mean to say he's not, but he's so wrong about justification. And if you buy into his understanding of justification, well, there's no reason really not to be a Roman Catholic or Orthodox.
But there's an aesthetic problem with evangelicalism. I mean, why do people really love N.T. Wright? It's because he can write.
Yeah. No, he...
And...
I've not been as entertained reading a really intellectually and scholarly deep work, except for when I read C.S. Lewis. When you read C.S. Lewis, you get the same kind of excitement that you get when you read
N.T. Wright.
Yeah, he's that kind of writer. He's really good. So you can pour through his works on the historical Jesus just quickly, because he's such a good writer.
I could have, except that you wrote in them, and so I can't read them, and right. I don't have them.
Wright is totally right on Jesus, by the way. He's got the Jesus stuff down. This is the Paul stuff.
I mean, this is a hard thing for me, because the quality of the writing matters to me so much that if I don't love the writing, I'm willing to put a book down. And it's one reason why I don't really love to read theology, because I'd rather read something beautiful, even if it's not completely
true. See, this is why I don't want to give you N.T. Wright, because I'm afraid that you'll be so enthralled by his writing, you won't be able to distinguish between the content and the style.
I think you should try it. I should try it out, though.
I've got to water you with the water of the word.
Okay. And I got to protect you. No, it's not water with the water of the word. You're quoting it wrong.
Why? I'm going to wash you
yeah.
with the water of the word. And so that would mean
oh my
keeping
gosh.
You away from books that might hurt your mind.
Yes, which, you know, what kind of bad person are you? You don't even know what I'm reading some of the time. That's very bad. You're bad.
I do. I see what you're reading all the time. Unless you're reading something secretly, I don't know.
And do you know what every single woman in the church, do you know what she's reading? And like,
I know what she shouldn't be reading.
I have to.
I do a good job of letting people know what's bad, I think, and what they shouldn't read, what they should stay away from.
Which is good, because when you tell people that,
it
doesn't make them want to run out and buy it.
My pastor says I shouldn't read
it. Don't read The Shack.
It's a
Don't
horrible,
read
horrible
it.
Book. Right.
So, I guess I should rush out and just check it out. So, I'm trying to think if I've read anything else. What was your favorite thing that we cooked this month?
I liked everything we made while we were camping, which surprises me.
You were so whiny about camping.
I didn't want to camp.
You were so...
It was a lot of trouble. I mean, washing dishes after doing dinner. Because you insisted on bringing not just... I mean, I thought we'd just buy paper plates, paper cups, throw them all away.
No.
But no, you had to bring the actual plates and actual cups.
Well, your mother bought us a beautiful set of red plates when she was here. And so I took them with us on camping.
Yes.
And it was very nice. It was beautiful.
It was pretty. It was very pretty. Yeah, I had a good time. I mean, the food was very good. And then we cooked over...
You made chili one day, which was really nice.
Uh-huh. But then we marinated beef and pork and cooked over the fire.
I made a sort of a quick dal thing. The kids were, like, starving.
Yeah.
With lentils and actually summer sausage with curry powder, which you wouldn't probably normally put together.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really good.
And that was really good. I was surprised. Everybody was crying and starving. So it took me about 7 minutes to mm-hmm. cook it all the way, and it was so good. I didn't make enough, and then people were angry. I was really
it is interesting, though, where our spread, our layout of three tents, utensils and candles and stuff everywhere, and then right next to us, the French...
Yeah, I really
the Viking
hated
French
those people.
Who show up with little tiny backpacks.
They had a box of pasta, a bowl, a spoon... I think they took turns using the bowl and the spoon. And,
They biked from Montreal to
They were biking to New York City.
With their children in tow.
Yeah, they had nothing. And we had we had an elaborate camping place with a dishwashing option and a little stove. And the, I had the trunk of the car open because I had a whole pantry assembled in the back of the car with... I brought my pantry from home, so we had, onions and garlic and spices and condensed milk. We had a lot of couscous, rice. We brought everything.
Yeah.
And so it was nicely arranged in the back of the car, and then we would open it up and be able to cook out of the back of the... So I like that we've worked on meat pies when we go on a picnic so that we don't have to buy lunch out, which is expensive. You've learned how to make an einkorn boiled crust,
mm-hmm.
pie crust. Boiled crust works better with einkorn than like cutting the butter and cold water into flour, which works well for regular flour.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really nice flaky crust. So we do cold water butter crust for regular flour, but for einkorn, we do boiled water, which is completely different. I don't know what do you have to do to
boil same really the same water. Process.
You cut the butter in, but then you pour boiling water.
While
you
shortened it, yeah.
Or shortening, yeah. And then
so it
doesn't.
Good.
It's not sticky. You don't have to keep adding flour once you've made the dough. It's really malleable, and you can easily.
Right.
Roll it out, and so you made samosa filling.
The samosa first time, yeah, samosa or samosa?
Samosa.
How would an Indian say it?
Oh, well, I don't know. the English way of saying it is samosa, or right. The way of saying it in French-speaking Ivory Coast.
Isamusa?
Isamusa.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, we did the Isamusa filling, and then just I made up an Indian filling a second time, which was, I thought they were really good.
Culturally appropriated Indian filling.
Yeah, right.
They were delicious. That was another big hit. I made too many apple ones, which I thought I made more apple filling ones the first time than meat filled ones, and I got in trouble because mm-hmm. the kids wanted the meat ones, which right. surprised me also. So that was really a nice thing to discover.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
I'm trying to remember what else we cooked. Well, every day Emma made a cake.
Man, she's good. She's a good baker.
She made a chocolate cake, like a this dense, moist chocolate cake. Well, sort of also fluffy, weirdly. She made a lemon cake that was mm-hmm. unbelievable. She made biscuits and muffins.
The cakes taste like they're from the store. I mean,
but in a good way.
In a good way. Like the good cake you buy at Wegmans, it tastes...
I mean, I know we've taken on a hushed quality to our talking here.
Right.
Because I feel in awe.
Yeah.
She's really good. I feel like she should devote herself more completely to baking, and I feel really sad because she's about to start school and she's not going to have time. Right. So I don't know. I mean, everybody came every day. After lunch, she would take over the kitchen and bake something like biscuits or muffins or cake. And then she would lay it all out. She would make tea and put out all the nice cups and serve up tea and cake to all her siblings.
She's going
to
make a husband very happy and fat.
I know. I mean, I feel she should.
Enormous.
It was really, I mean, I was trying really hard not to eat cake, but, and it disappeared. I realized the children ate an entire chocolate cake. I got this very thin, and I kept asking her, you know, you didn't eat the whole cake. You can serve it again. I couldn't fathom, but they ate it all in one sitting, this massive cake. They just devoured it. So, that was a nice
yeah, it was good
thing.
So, did we win any point? I mean, as far as school goes, do they have to get days off because of all the field trips that we took? Because we did all educational field
That's
trips.
That's true.
That's all we did. We went to...
We should count those.
Right.
Yeah, we went... Oh, okay, so the place that I liked best was Azilum.
Yeah, that was it was a place where, speaking of the French Revolution, French immigrés came during the revolution.
What immigré? Immigrants. Immigré? Are you trying to say the French word? That's say immigrant.
You
say
no, you said it in English. It's in English. It's
immigrants.
It's been appropriated in English. That people use that immigrant. Word. In immigré.
Immigrant.
No. That's what, anyway. These French nobles who were escaping the terror set up bought some land, settled in
Pennsylvania on this bend in the Susquehanna.
Right,
so there's like
about
this
an
sort
hour
of
away from us, and they also built
although
a house.
It was really 2.5 hours because we followed the GPS in one of the most horrifying driving experiences ever.
Because it asked us the question: do you want the direct route or
the shortest route? Which was wrong. Right. It wasn't the shortest route.
Because there was bridges out,
there were bridges going through.
Like, we went on dirt roads in some cases. It took an hour on the way back because we went by the highway, but it took 2 hours on the way. But anyway, so they even built a house for Marie Antoinette, hoping that she would be able...
Although they started building it at kind of the same moment that she was killed. Like, they didn't know, of course.
They didn't have the internet back then.
But it took them months and months to hear the news that even... that.
Right.
So it was a, but none of the, what the interesting thing is, and I thought this would be terrible, that the, none of the original settlement is there. It's all gone. Like, Marie Antoinette's house isn't there. I thought it was there.
Yeah, no, I thought that you were going to see.
But it wasn't. What was there was... a house built by the son of one of the members of this community who stayed on and then built this big fancy weekend house or summer house for himself and then sort of kept some of the items that were in the Marie Antoinette house. But it was surprisingly interesting just going through this house that was even built at a later time. I don't know why it was so compelling, the whole story.
Well, yeah, it was well, because they were all people who'd escaped with their lives from a...
Yeah, no, I mean, the story was compelling, but it was curious to me that even though none of it was there, it was still very cool to go and look at the whole...
Yeah, the house. I wish there had been more things said still standing while I was missing them. And they need more money. They need to be able to do some more excavations to find more houses and maybe
any houses. Yeah, they don't have anything.
One house was built by.
That's what I just said.
Yeah, but they need more. So.
You just contradicted me. There's a later built house built by the son of somebody. There's no part of the original community.
But you stopped me from saying the rest of my sentence. Okay. I was going to say that, but you stopped me from saying that.
Now we're staring daggers at each other. I loved that museum. I liked it lots more than Fort William Henry.
I liked Fort William Henry better because I have childhood memories of Fort William Henry. I went as a 6-year-old boy, I think, or something.
It was too shiny, though.
It was rebuilt.
And I think the museums, like, I like these little museums that aren't that well known, mm-hmm. where none of this stuff is behind glass. I mean, they just have things sort of laying out, which is bad for them, and probably things are they need to have better preservation of things at Azilum. But it's nice that you can go, and the person who led the tour let the kids try on hats and touch things, and there's this really old harpsichord that they let us touch the keys and like play.
That should be behind a glass. I mean, Talleyrand played that.
Yeah, they should put that behind glass.
Because he visited Azilum once. Yeah, and, right.
So, I mean, but that's what's charming about it is that it's not.
It's just there.
It's just there, so you can walk in and breathe on everything. And
right.
That's my favorite kind of museum, though. It's a lot. It's more interesting than a perfectly curated.
Right.
With everything behind glass.
Right.
So, that was cool.
My favorite was the Saratoga battlefield, but no.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was amazing. It went on and on.
You had a drive. We had a driving tour, and you could go see.
Okay, but a driving tour.
Land where people were.
A driving tour means you drive up, look at it, and keep driving. You had to walk at each stop. You had to walk like felt like miles.
It was like maybe 50 yards at the most.
A sweep of land with nothing there.
But then they showed you where the placements were, the troop placements were, the lines were, where people
on
got
little
shot.
Pictures. Like they should...
We got to see where Benedict Arnold got shot in the
That was battle. Amazing. That was
like, you stayed in the car for that. I was tired
by that point.
I can't believe you did.
Everybody
that.
Was hungry. You wouldn't let us have lunch until we got to the end. And then we had been promised
that
there was going to be.
Lunch. You didn't bring lunch.
I brought lunch. It was in the It was in the car the whole time, and you wouldn't let us stop and eat it.
I don't think I said
and
that.
And then
no, I didn't,
there
no,
was this big house that turned out only to be open on the weekends, and we didn't get to see the house because we went during the week.
Right.
So.
That's not my fault.
But you promised that we would see the house, so.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was closed.
Well, but you should have looked harder at the website, so. So, yes, that was not my favorite. I'm sure the kids remember it fondly, too. Getting in and out of the car. We're going back. So, I think...
It's beautiful, though. The battlefield is beautiful. It was really great. Yeah, it was a sunny day. Nice to be out there. It was a national park, so everything was done really well.
There were mosquitoes. Yeah, now it's all over, though. Our vacation is done. We're back to work, so we were only going to talk for half an hour. Did we do that?
Looks like we've talked for about, let's see, about 48 minutes.
Okay, wow.
Well, this is like preaching, you just keep going.
You just keep going and going. I know that you have a lot to do to prepare for my birthday tomorrow. So I'm sure we should go on... And get ready also for the eclipse I was going to try to join Eclipse
Total
with...
Total Eclipse of the Heart. Have you heard that song?
Yes, I have heard that song.
I used to think that we were falling in love, and now we're only falling apart.
I was trying to...
Nothing can... Like, nothing can...
You don't even know the words.
This Total Eclipse of the Heart.
What I was going to say, somebody should join the word eclipse to apocalypse. Because that would be like Sharknado. But I don't know how to do that.
Eclipocalypse.
Eclipocalypse. Yeah. We're not ready for it.
Eclipse lips.
Eclipse lips. All right. Well, we're going to go. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.